Hi, this is Catherine McNamara, and you're listening to My Dad on All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
If it's a Wednesday, that means it's the Lynch Kenny Hour or the Kenny Lynch Hour, however we've defined it. I don't think we've done that yet. So welcome with me once again, Jeff Kenny, Colonel of the United States Marine Corps. Jeff, retired. Jeff, what's going on?
Hey, Mike, how are you? I'm doing good.
I'm all right. And also joining us is Tim Lynch, former corpsman, United States Navy, and infantry officer, United States Marine Corps, retired. Timmy, what's up?
Not much, Mac. Thanks for having me back on.
Oh, no, we love it. Are you kidding me? And you got your new mic, Timmy. You sound like a million bucks.
Yeah, I know. I'm all excited. I figured out technology. It was a browser. That's what foiled my first attempt. Now I feel like I've accomplished something.
Hey, first of all, I got to tell a story. I got an email yesterday, and I get these emails, and honestly, they absolutely make my day. So, just imagine you being me. I know that's hard, so if you can't, I'll understand. But all of a sudden, at 9:58, this bombs into your mailbox. Sir, I just found your podcast yesterday and listened to the conversation with Lieutenant Colonel Cuomo intently. Enjoyed his perspective of opportunity. Listening live now from the East Coast here in the swamps of North Carolina, where I retired a few years ago from our beloved Corps after 20 years of privileged service alongside some of the greatest men and Marines. This morning I started listening to your podcast with Colonel Kenny, retired. He was my company commander in Weapons 2-2. I spent a night or two on Lucky's Mound in the FSCC with a brilliant and funny Kenny. I didn't know there was two. Hearing you two speak of mortars, arty, elevation and deflection, whiz wheels and plotting boards brought much joy to my heart. He is an example of the great men and Marines I speak of. Having been diagnosed with severe PTSD, my natural tendency was to withdraw upon my retirement. It's been a 5-year fight to get back into life, and finding this podcast with your message of post-traumatic winning is damn near fate. So, for what it's worth, from one leatherneck to another, thank you, sir. Respectfully submitted, and Master Sergeant, United States Marine Corps, retired. So those things bomb into my inbox. Like, how cool is that shit?
Yeah, that's great. And thanks for sending
that. Awesome,
that,
man.
Now, Jeff, do you remember him?
I think so. I remember remember that Lucky's Mound and all that stuff and doing the FDC stuff. I had him. I had a guy named Danner who's, a lieutenant colonel, maybe even a colonel now. The FDC guys were smart and funny and stuff, and they worked their ass off. And they were into it, you know what I mean? They're into the whole, like we talked about last week, into the whole math of the thing. So, more than me, actually. I mean, I was into it because I don't want to drop a mortar round on somebody by accident, you know, but that we didn't intend to. But, yeah. They were just, that's the type of thing that makes it great to be a Marine officer and have those guys working for you because you just need to, stand in front, point the right direction, man. They just chew through it.
Right. No, and let me tell you that, if you can't be doing it, I would say pretty cool next to doing it is what we're doing now, which is, talking about, not only Marine culture and issues and things like that, but the whole post-traumatic winning thing and talking about, living with the trauma and that you can not only live a great life, but you can live a life you probably didn't expect to live because you can change the lives of other people. And that's pretty cool. So, no, just an email like that, changes the whole day. Like, how do I have a bad day? I got that email at 10 o'clock. At 7:30, I was just telling Jeff this before we went on the air. No, At 4:30 in the morning, I wake up, I roll over, I look at my phone. I thought, well, I'll see who's emailing me. And I get an email from General Zinni. I'd asked him to come on and talk about Iwo Jima. Sure, Mac, I'll come on. So it's like, so I get that one at 4:30. I'd get this just before 10 o'clock. It's like, how is that not already a great day by 10 in the morning?
Oh, yeah.
Answer, it is a great day. So,
yeah.
So anyway. Hey, I had Scott Como on. I don't know if either of you two know him. He's a former group chief at IOC. And he's written, he and some friends have written an article that's entitled Not Yet Openly at War, But Still Mostly at Peace. And it deals with roles and missions of the Marine Corps. And I think we've all kind of watched the dwindling amphib population. We've watched the increased lethality of long-arm surface-to-surface missiles and air-to-surface missiles. And kind of like, well, if amphibious operations are our core mission, where does that leave the Marine Corps? I'm curious. Your thoughts on that subject, Jeff? You know you're working around it all the time. Your thoughts?
Right, well, for Scott Cuomo, he went through IOC. I don't know if Timmy was still there, but I know me and Mel were still in the instruction group there at IOC when he went through. And he's a sharp kid. And then I ran into him again. I was still on active duty. And he was the group chief there at IOC. And so he's really a forward-thinking kid. He was into using IOC lieutenants to push the basically push the envelope regarding what we could do with the long legs of the Osprey and a lot of different communication stuff for command and control, as well as, you know, a few guys put in a place that no enemy would ever expect them due to the, you know, the fact that we had things like the Osprey and other things, you know, some of the drone technology we got and everything. He was really into that. And I have to tell you, though, the whole lethality thing, it has been a conundrum for us, because the better we get, the less likely we are to have an adversary that faces us that way. I mean, if you look at what we did in Iraq and in Afghanistan, the enemy never tried to face us face-to-face, head-to-head, combined arms to combined arms, because there's no way they could ever do. And I talked to the first guy I advised, had been a brigade commander for Saddam in 2003, and he was a Shiite guy. And he vividly described for me what it was like to be a brigade commander on the other end of the U.S. combined arms assault. And it was riveting, you know, what he said.
What did he say?
Yeah, well, he said, we'd be driving around Al-Assad, right? And he'd say, oh, I got attacked by those. He'd see cobras parked there by the airstrip. And I couldn't talk. And we couldn't see. And we couldn't get supplied. And then we were getting messages that we found out later on after I was in a POW cell that they were false messages sent by, you know, U.S. And we're totally confused, totally bewildered. And finally, he points at AAV. One of these things pulled up about 200 yards behind my CP and assaulted my command post and took us all prisoner. So, you know, he really, you know, showed what it was like. And a lot of times I think the enemy is like, how could that? We'll waltz these guys in, bleed them, you know, and make a big deal out of it. I.O. That's why when you get hit in Iraq or Afghanistan, there's always some guy there nearby with either a video camera or now an iPhone where he's filming the thing so they can put it on YouTube and get out there on the internet and make, you know, try and affect morale and stuff like that. And it works. It works. I mean, you know, the stuff that we went through from 2004, you know, really till 2009 was, you know, an IO struggle, and at first they had the upper hand, starting with when they filmed that guy, Nicholas Berg, being beheaded, slow beheading, right there on YouTube for everybody to see. It was a shocker.
Right.
And, you know, and that type of way they're going to come at us necessitates that.
Okay, so, but no, I want to talk about peer to peer, because now we've pivoted to the Pacific, and how draw me a scenario where the Marine Corps gets on amphibs and then gets someplace. I mean, we don't do that. We had a chance to do that in Desert Storm and opted not to do that, and we controlled all of it. So I mean, I think we've all thought about this kind of stuff. Like, how does it work? How does it happen? So I'm just curious in a peer to peer, not anybody else. We'll get there. You know, and you know, we tend not to go on amphibs anyway. But when we talk about our signature mission, which is amphibious warfare, how does it work in a near peer? And again, I wouldn't even talk about the Russians, because I think the Russians are bullshit. I mean, they have nuclear weapons, and we have to do that dance with them. But their GDP is 6% of ours, right? Reason Putin put his target list on TV, because he has to do IO, because he can't do hard currency missile building. Can't do it. He doesn't have the economy to do it. It's a joke. He's a charade, and everybody knows that the Dr. Evil impersonation at some point ends, right? With him getting his pants pulled down and saying, yeah, you're right, I'm sorry. So, anyway, but China's a different story. Their GDP is 60% of ours, and there's people that will tell you it's more than 60% of ours, and their military gets stronger every year. How does, in a fight in the Pacific, given the lethality, and again, I know some people don't like that word, but given the lethality of missiles, given satellites, right? How does the Marine Corps, how do we do Incheon again? Can we do Incheon again? Or if we even hazard that, you're going to get a regiment blown out of the water when you can't afford to do that. So, Tim, thoughts? And Jeff, I'll come back to you. It was just interesting. Go ahead.
Well, what Jeff was talking about, the IO fight, he brings up something that has to do with China, and that's their concept of unrestricted warfare. And if I understood Colonel Como's concepts correctly, he's talking about very distributed and dispersed forces that are out in a much smaller packages, but able to leverage the lethality. And I would submit to you, we're all victims of our experience, and my experience was driving all over Taliban-infested areas in local clothes and getting away with it, right? And I believe firmly that in the future, plausible deniability is worth as much as firepower. And if you start looking at these little packets you've got spread forward, and you're willing to risk some plausible deniability, I mean, it doesn't have to be that plausible. I would say that we should have been sending teams like the Celis Scouts, the old Celis Scouts used to do in Rhodesia, sending them across into Afghanistan. If they get caught, we just say, hey, this is like the little green men from Russia. Now, we don't know who those guys are. I know that there's plenty of people that will accept that risk. I mean, when you're sheep dipped, that's the rules. And I think that we need to think about the unrestricted warfare concepts. And you've got to shy away from the risk aversion that would keep you in uniform and on easily identified ships. If you're not on identified ships, what threat are Chinese missiles to you? And I think that's worth considering, but it takes a lot of courage to implement, because you're sending little detachments out there not under that tight of control, and that seems to be unnatural for us right now.
Yeah. I agree. I think exactly along those lines. And, the thing of it is, we've been trying to pivot our way out of the CENTCOM area for 20-some years. I mean, actually, 30 years. We're going to get out of this thing, and we're going to get back to what's really important, watching out for China. But here's the fact of it. The only other credible combined arms force, as well as nuclear force, is China, really. I mean, if you have a nuke, you're in the game. No matter what size country you are, because the amount of destruction that you can visit on wherever you choose, wherever you can get the thing, makes it prohibitive. And consequently, when you talk about China, I think both of us and China are going to do this proxy dance to avoid getting into, a latter-day version of the Cuban Missile Crisis in the Pacific. And I think what Tim says is exactly the way you should go. It's guys like these kids in MARSOC now and the other special ops things. And these people, we're going to have to evolve to a place where, because of the overwhelming information avalanche that we have all the time. People who actually can say, we can say, I don't know about them. And, you know, and that's awful. That is, that's antithetical from how we usually are. We always take responsibility for our guys. We try never to leave anybody behind. It's part of our religion, not just us, but like the Rangers, everybody, you know, everyone feels that way. The horrible thought in your mind is that you left your guy behind. But here you deliberately put them behind and you got to write them off.
Let me just say, so the concept would be this, right? So we would struggle to get there. And once the shooting part begins, we would struggle to get there. Anybody, right? So the answer to that is, so you already got to be there. So when we say distributed ops, we mean, right, partnered with the Vietnamese, partnered with the Philippines, partnered with Indonesia, and there in, you know, company battalion strengths, if that's what, right, with separate small amphibious ships, high speed, right, working in the littoral areas, and your logistics are partly on the boat, partly ashore, right? You can come and go. Your speed is part of your security, but you are, you know, you are cyber capable. You are long range fires capable, right? You have your own organic firepower, but you are already in the area. 83% of the oil that China uses comes through the Straits of Hormuz. Okay, all the major all in the region, all the major information cables, fiber optic cables, go through the Straits of Hormuz. So listening to them conceptually, as I try to wrap my head around it, right? So you are already there, right? So you are relevant, and you're out of this construct of, you know, what 38 amphibs Marine Corps needs to do 2 MEB size elements, right? Not that shipping would not be used, however. I mean, the Marine Corps would be forward deployed to the theater. Now, the one thing Jeff said, I don't believe it's not an either-or proposition, because you are never going to be able to turn your back on Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, ISIS, and all that. You still have to play and be in that game and be capable of crushing that when it rears its ugly head. And so my thought was, I don't know if you guys have entertained any of this, and I wouldn't, and the irregular thing, I don't know so much about, and maybe that would have to be entertained. The reason I brought this up is the concept of how does the Marine Corps get to that fight, right? How does it, if it's losing its amphibious mission, because we haven't done one since Incheon, right? How, you know, what does the Marine Corps do if it's being asked by, in the National Defense Strategy, what do you do now? You're a second land army? Do we want that? Do we need that? So I just wondered if you had thoughts about, go ahead.
Always think about that. And here's the thing. There's a shit ton of amphibious work that's always done. It just doesn't result in a assault against, you know, an opposed enemy shore. That doesn't mean there's not amphib stuff going on. Like right now.
Yeah, but you can't get there because you'll get your shit blown away.
Well, that's the thing. What you're talking about is devising some way of achieving, if necessary, a fait accompli. In other words, you're grabbing a piece of terrain that once you have it, it's prohibitive for a lot of economic and other reasons, maybe because of nuclear deterrent, for the enemy to push you off of it. In other words, you know what I'm saying?
Right.
Like you talked about the Straits of Hormuz. If the Straits of Hormuz, if some key aspects of that get taken, then, you know, especially if, you know, we have strong allies who are willing to help us, then it becomes part of a negotiation, the fact that you have it. And then by the same token, we always got to be watching out for them doing a fait accompli upon us, where once they have something, we know that we don't have the will back in the United States to do another Iwo Jima to push them off, you know, whether it be some part of Taiwan or all of Taiwan or wherever, you know, or maybe even Oki. Who knows what the future is going to hold that way.
Right.
You know, go ahead, Tim.
No, I was going to say, the other thing on most any place you want to employ these guys, I'm willing to bet, that you could fall in on existing DEA infrastructure that could at least identify or get you, you know, across the beach and into a position of advantage vis-a-vis the local situation, and you don't even have to say it's you. That's what I mean about the plausible deniability. There's all kinds
of... How do you get there, Timmy? How do you move a large force there, though? That's my question.
Oh, that's what I'm saying is you come off of shipping, you have mass immediately on the shore. I mean,
do you think that they're going to allow the ship to close there?
No.
Yes?
No, I'm not... I'm not talking amphibious shipping. I'm just talking about
any ship. I agree. So all of a sudden, we put you and you and your regiment on the Titanic, and we're going to sell you across the ocean, and they're going to be okay with that.
I kind of thought that was what the argument was leaning towards. No. When you guys were discussing the future, because the large amphibs invasion, that's not going to happen. It's useful for humanitarian disasters, but that's
right.
About it.
Uncontested. Well,
And you and I, you guys both know, because we all three of us have been through this, when you can't achieve total surprise, you achieve surprise by desensitization. And I think that in that crowded sea lanes between Japan and China and Southeast Asia there, they are desensitized to our presence, just like we, in a way, are desensitized to theirs. So it's almost, it's a chessboard. And so consequently, you know, if you wanted to grab a key piece of terrain, and now you have that key piece of terrain hostage, in a way it's kind of like what Hussein did when he took Kuwait. He was playing chess. Do the United States really have the gonads to push me out, and I'm going to make as bloody as I can, I'm going to put the word out on the news that we are? And if you guys remember all the projections about the masses and tens of thousands of Marines, another Iwo Jima, another World War One. You know, you remember that? They misjudged H.W. Bush. He had the guts to go ahead and push him out. You know, but I think that's what we're talking about. We're talking about having the forces are right there, crouched against each other, as Mac described. If somebody was to do that, how, and your question, I think, Mac, is how would we do it amphibiously with the dearth of, you know, of resources that we have right now? That's what you're saying, right?
Right. If it's a pure event, all right, and let's just say it's South China Sea, let's say it's Taiwan, right? I mean, throw, I don't know if I want to talk about South Korea. I won't throw them in the mix, but say it's in that region. How, if you're talking about a pure, how are you going to get, you know, big numbers on ships into that region without, I mean, is the risk too much?
That's why they do all these exercises all the time.
Yeah.
So it's a matter of desensitization. You know, the whole team spirit, or not team spirit, what's the exercise, the big one we do in Egypt every year?
Bright Star.
Bright Star originally started as a desensitization to make the Iranians not be alarmed by the fact that we're practicing flying all kind of aircraft into Egypt and across over into Jordan. And because we're going to get ready to try and rescue the hostages. And that's what that started as. And I'll tell you, the hostage thing could have gone better if it weren't for some, you know, key accidents really on the ground. It might have worked. And what we're talking about is on a bigger scale, doing something like that where, okay, bang, we got a strategic island off the coast of Korea or off the coast of South China Sea, you know, that now we got it, and now that makes it untenable for them to support their fake islands that they built out there, and they got to pull back or they got to go to war. And here's the other thing. No matter what you do, no matter what side you're on, IO-wise, you can't appear to have been beaten. And because your population won't stand for it. Now, the Chinese don't really have to worry about that in the same way we do, but they have to worry about some of their clients, like North Korea.
Right.
You know, like right now, North Korea, there's a seduction game going on between us and the Chinese and the North Koreans. And now the Vietnamese are, even though that's just a place they're meeting, really, the Vietnamese are, you know, part of that because since the war, which they defeated us, since that happened, because they've become more mercantile, you know, and they basically are showing that we were like you, North Korea, and now we have relations with the United States, and look it, we're doing good. Now, I don't want to get off the subject there, but what I'm saying is all that comes from, you know, this game of you have two very powerful forces breathing in each other's faces, crouching with all kind of, you know, resources, military resources, and, you know, each of them having pressure, different types of pressure, but pressure for them to do something to get the upper hand. And that's where we're at with right now with that, I think.
Okay, so you still didn't answer my question, though.
I forgot what it was.
Yeah, man. I know. That's where
I forgot who you are.
It's the mid-10-8 hour. Come on, man. We're not supposed to stay on track.
How do you get a force into the region, or do you have to? Don't you have to be there? Because you can't count that you're going to have. If you're not already there, if we're talking conflict with China, right? If you're not already there, how do you get there, right? And so, to me, if you're going to move large forces, right, then you have to destroy their ability to see what across the ocean, right? You have to knock out their satellites. You have to knock down everything that they can see with, and then you got to continue to do it as they try to regenerate it, right? And
any move like that would just be like pulling the fire alarm in a high school.
Right. Well, okay. So I mean, but that's the point I'm making. The fire alarm's been pulled. Okay.
Right.
And we're talking about that. So now, as this thing gets going, right, and we look at the list of forces that are gonna play in this arena, right? Two MEBs sorting from the east and west coast, getting to the region. Is that gonna be one of the options that the president looks at and says, boom, that's the one we need? Answer: I think we all know that, right? The answer to that is no. That's not going to be in the list. So if the Marine Corps doesn't have a role, what's the Marine Corps role? What do we stake our? What do we become?
If who would have a role? I mean, if we can't get there,
well, that's a good question. Who has? So what is the configuration that somebody's got to be in, right? To be the force of choice there.
Well, it's going to have to be some kind of seaborne, at least, if nothing else, just for support. There's no way you could, if you start, even if you're doing something like what we were doing in Iraq or Afghanistan, you need more support than you can just constantly fly in. You know, you need a lot of shipping. You know, if you're going to have do that. And why not us? Of course us. We only got 32 ships.
But you
got
to be there.
32 amphibs. But you
I think that was the interesting point about what Lieutenant Colonel Cuomo, and there's let me read everybody's name because there's a whole it was a series of different articles that they consolidated. So Lieutenant Colonel Scott Cuomo, Captain Olivia Garan, Major Jeff Cummings, and Lieutenant Colonel Noah Spatero. I interviewed Spatero, I think.
Yeah, I know him, too.
And he's a really interesting guy because he was saying, hey, we can lease drones. We can lease Reapers, right? We do not have to destroy our fixed-wing assets doing ISR over these places. They can loiter forever. And it's like, okay, well, why aren't we doing that? Because it sounds like it's like smarter. It's like it sounds like dumb guy's suggestion, and this, and whatever. So it was anyway. So they wrote this thing, and really, you know, what they come to is that you've got to be forward deployed. You've got to be on smaller platforms that are fast. You're going to leverage electronic warfare. You're going to, you know, all the different firing platforms to include, you know, the F-35 and all the things that it does in this fast kind of lightning war that would take place because of the lethality of long range fires. And the way you can see. So it's kind of interesting, and I think it's exciting for the Marine Corps because I think we've looked at it and scratched our head and said, okay, other than being a second land army and having this kind of notional amphibious capability, that really when you work at the MEF level and you try to do amphibious operations, and what you hear back is, yeah, they can't support because they can't get to sea. Well, what happened? Well, you know, this the well deck was going to get repaired in April, but that got screwed up, and now it's rolled to June, so they're out. And what about this one? Well, they're doing this, and they've got this repair. And, I mean, consistently, that's the song and dance that you get from the amphibious fleet. I know on the Pacific side, at least when I was there a few years ago, I won't ask if it's changed because it's not my business. But, again, it leaves one scratching their head. How does this work? What is our role? And how do we become the force of choice to say, yes, we want them, and we want them to go get that right now?
Right. I have to tell you, it's pretty simple, but it's difficult. Because that was my last job on active duty, you know, that I left in 2017. The maintenance and the upkeep and basically the modernization of the amphibious fleet is not a priority for the U.S. Navy, and they're allowed to not have it as a priority right now. And all that could change, you know, with some pressure put on them from above. And I don't know what, you know, General Mattis was doing when he was Secretary of Defense in regards to that. I just don't know. But I know that, you know, that could change. That could change pretty quick. And it's true, you know, that we have these amphib platforms that in their day, they're outstanding at, you know, hurling a force onto an opposed beach or at least an area where, you know, the enemy would soon be apparent. But it's not like that anymore, and it's because of the priorities of the Navy. I mean, you got the nuke subs, you have their aircraft. You know, they have their pointy ships and they're just the amphibs are of, you know, they're fourth place horse in that race.
Right, anytime you see them fight over the budget, what's the first thing the Navy offers up?
Yeah,
amphibs. Like right. whoa, hey, wait a minute, like right. you want to give away our ride to the fight, and how the hell does that work? And the answer is it doesn't. And I'm not saying that you're wrong, Jeff, but I'll tell you what. The Navy doesn't, the Navy certainly doesn't hold their amphib fleet in high regard.
That's what I mean. Because they're not held, their feet are not held to the fire in regards to amphibious capability. And the reason is because most of the people we have in Congress, even the ones with military experience, they have this coin military experience now.
Right.
And so consequently, that's almost more, it's got too much of a law enforcement type flavor into it. And so now everybody is a veteran of heavy combat. If you just appeared in Iraq or Afghanistan, you know, but it's not the same combat as they were doing in the Second World War, you know, where amphibious operations were the only way we could win. Or even later on. I mean, you know, we talk a lot about the semi, for war, the Vietnam War is a semi-conventional struggle in a lot of ways. So those guys in 2-4 went to Daido. They were fighting just as hard as the guys were fighting in Okinawa in 1945, and pretty much the same type of tactics. And so consequently, you know, and how they got from, you know, from the safe spot into the Quaviet River Valley there was off amphibs. They were the special landing force.
Yeah, but if you can't get there, then what?
Well, you can get there if the nation decides that amphibious platforms are a priority. And right now, they haven't. And the reason is, there's not pressure put on them from Congress to do that. That's just not one of their priorities. We try our ass off to try and get them to. We try. You know, you talk to General Furness about all the really ingenious with things and deals that were being made just to give us a couple extra mid-sized amphibs. You know, the effort's there in the military's part, but they just don't see it.
Wait. When you say the military, who do you mean? The Marine Corps?
Yeah. Yeah, people up there in OLA.
Right. No, they're trying.
Yeah.
But the Navy doesn't see it, and the DOD isn't saying, hey, Navy, you need to pay attention to this. So where does that leave the Marine Corps relative to, you know, roles and missions? Missions, it leaves it like, you know, nowhere.
Right. Service likes to think of the future war as being their war. This is going to be all in the air. This is going to be all at sea. This is going to be us getting hurled into, you know. And the truth is, The enemy knows our strengths and weaknesses. Who would ever go into the combined arms arena with us, you know, voluntarily? And I interrupted Tim again. I'm sorry.
Only an idiot would. Only, like, Saddam Hussein idiotic people would.
Right.
Well, the other thing is, you know, if you look at some of the recent books that have come out about the future, like Cocktails from Hell from Austin Bay and New Rules of War from Sean McFate and whatnot, they say that half of the globe, half the countries in the globe are experiencing some type of armed conflict right now, and these durable centers of disorder are going to be a problem in the future. I would submit to you that most places where we would need to land and put combat forces ashore are not the places that got long-range ship missiles that are going to shoot at us. And if we did have to go in the face of somebody that had that capability, that's like we might well have to do it, but I don't think that's a line they're willing to cross, because you know what's going to happen when they cross that line and take out one of our ships. All hell is going to break loose.
We're talking about the Chinese, though.
I'm not talking to the Chinese. I don't think the Chinese are going to be the next problem we got to deal with.
I'm talking about the Chinese.
Okay, well, you're talking about the Chinese.
I can't imagine the scenario, but when they start launching anti-ship missiles at that point, brother, you're just a step away from nuclear. What do you think is happening to China at that point? I mean, the amount of damage we're going to inflict on them. I mean, that's crossing the line.
No, I agree. Okay,
go ahead.
You get to that point, right? And How do you become the force of choice? In my opinion, and I think they're right about this, you've got to be in the region, right? You can't. You're not going to get. You know. Anyway, you've got to be in the region. That's my point. You've got to already be there, right? So go ahead.
You got to move Camp Pendleton to Australia.
Right. You know what?
I'm not kidding.
Absolutely.
I'm not kidding.
No. When we talk forward deployed, we mean you got to be forward in the Pacific.
We go to Vietnam and say, hey, buddy.
Yeah.
How about, you want some more of that American money?
and the concept of being able to land combat formations off a ship where you're not exposing your tail end to the environment. I mean, if admin techs could kill people with a computer, you take them, but you don't. You leave them on a ship. You take your gunfighters ashore. You can go ahead and run a pretty sustained operation and chew up some pretty serious ass and then bring them back on the damn ship. And I mean, that's that right there, because most of the time, I believe, in the future when we need to go ashore and start yoking people up, it's not going to be under threat of having anti-ship missiles at you. I think the small boats would be a bigger threat. But it's going to be a ballsy bastard to cross that line with us. And I don't see anybody doing it. And that's what that unrestricted warfare is all about, because they don't want to do that. I mean, Russia sure as hell doesn't want to do that.
Yeah, and I think you're right, Tim. Right. I think something else, too, Mac. They get us chasing our tails in places like, basically these coin situations we get ourselves into.
Right.
And pretty soon there's and just like it is now with our amphibs in Congress, they're like, what do we need this big stuff for? We don't need it. Really, what we need is small guys who wear beards and, you know, look like they're locals going in, you know, fighting. And so pretty soon the Chinese watch us as our conventional force and our conventional naval force and our conventional amphibious forces decay and decay and decay until finally they do something and we can't do anything about it. I mean, they like to do stuff slow. I mean, the Chinese are still pissed at us for the Boxer Rebellion problem. So, you know, it's like men before. You know, so it's like they can wait. And the other thing is they got no pressure. They have no pressure like we would have if our people were starving. Their people put up a lot of shit before they finally, you know, get unruly.
So what's the answer? What have we agreed on as an answer for this crap? Have we?
Well, I think what we got to do is we got to make our case. You know, we have to make our case in a more effective way. We're saying, look, we need to have a good capability to do this. Otherwise, we're going to have to do it. You know what I mean? The less capable our military forces are, the more likely it is we're going to have to use them in a desperate situation. And that's, you know, that's a hard thing to to justify when
okay,
you're talking
so,
about
so let me ask you this. Okay, so let's just say this. Let's just say we move Camp Pendleton to Australia, right? And let's just say we rotate regiments between the Philippines, between Vietnam, and someplace in Indonesia, Singapore, something like that, right? We have some kind of rotation that goes on like that. Does that sound something that, like, or is that us chasing, is that the Marine Corps postured for the next century? For the fight that you have to be postured for, with the other whack-a-mole fights, you can adjust to that. I'm curious about that.
Me too.
You know, well, for one thing, if you base a significant amount of Marines in Australia permanently, it's going to make recruiting pretty damn easy. But the other thing is that would make a lot of sense if. Yeah. If you could leverage the Australians and the Koreans and the Japanese to build and crew some amphibs for us, to give us the amphib lift. I mean, why not? They've got the money. It's in their best interest. I don't believe Australia is actually pulling their load, given that they are depending, you know, almost entirely on over-the-water trade. They may be. I really don't know, but I don't recall the Australian Navy as being particularly large or that capable. But if you're willing to do that and you start leveraging your partners and saying, hey, boys, we need some amphibious lift, because you're not going to get it from the Navy right now, not anytime soon, not when Congress is focusing on trying to end air travel in 10 years. I mean, Jesus. So that seems to be a bridge too far.
Yeah,
at the
moment. But hold on. Okay, so hold on. What happens if we said, okay, here's what we'll do. We'll trade you know, some of that future amphibious lift for 60 amphibious boats. I don't even know what I'm saying right now, but 60 amphibious littoral boats that carry 100 Marines apiece.
Yeah, because you don't want them building those billion-dollar things that we've got,
right,
for crying out loud.
Right.
Nobody can afford that, but they can build good, safe boats. Hell, Japanese got hot tubs on their boats. I understand they're very nice. You know what I'm saying?
Shit. All right.
Yeah, I would be like that, a hot tub in the middle of the ocean. Wow. That'd be awesome. I mean, it's hot water, too. Japanese don't fool around with cold water.
Unbelievable. All right. You guys were each instructed to bring a topic. So, Lynch, give us yours.
I saw something today that I thought was amusing, and I wanted to bring it up because I bet you Jeff knows or has heard of this. Do you guys remember ever watching a Twilight Zone episode? This is back in the 60s, where a little kid, in the case it was Billy Mummy, it's called It's a Good Life. And he has he has his entire town that he's cut off from the rest because he's got some kind of mind control alien thing going. He won't let people use cars. He won't let people use lawnmowers because he doesn't like it. He doesn't like electricity. He takes that all out. And anybody that pisses him off goes to the cornfield and doesn't come back. And the people are reduced to growing their own food. It's the only way they can get food. And then ultimately at the end of the show, he gets really pissed at everybody and he causes this heavy snow is going to destroy the crop. People are going to starve to death. Do you guys ever remember seeing a Twilight Zone episode like that?
I do not.
I've never seen the one because that's similar to the one they made in the movie, The Twilight Zone, with the kid that controlled he had his whole family terrorized because he all of a sudden gained these powers. And it was from a Billy Mummy episode in that.
It was based off of that one. I bring that up apropos. That's the Green New Deal for us, my friends. Not that I think it is a snowball chance, a hell of it, but just think about it. That's the Green New Deal.
Similar. My topic is not similar, but it's part of that. Because I said my topic is going to be about our higher education system and how it's perverted. It's compromised. It's not good anymore. It's really affecting the secondary and elementary education. And a prime evidence of that is this congressional representative from the Bronx with these stupid ideas that she's foisted, and apparently she's now in control of the Democratic Party. And besides what she's saying and how foolish it is and everything and how you know, cost science fiction it is. The fact that she didn't even know the branch of the government. So that is what I mean. They're not educated. They're indoctrinated, and that is going to have a profound effect on us. That is basically Karl Marx stealing a march on us by getting.
No, let me tell you. I don't think that's the problem. I think that's a symptom of the problem. Here's what I think.
Okay, that's a symptom of what problem?
That we have allowed, by virtue of this canard that we call free trade, we've allowed the jobs that used to support a robust middle class to leave the country. As a result, you have a growing and growing lower class and a shrinking middle class. You have a class of laborers who no longer believe in the American dream. And it's that loss of hope that, and then our educational system certainly is a part of it, but it's that loss of hope that allows people like her, right, to stand up and then be cheered all over the place. And I recall reading Morris's first book on Theodore Roosevelt. When Roosevelt is on a train, he's coming back from Buffalo after President Garfield has been shot.
Right.
And Roosevelt is coming through like the back alleys and the bowels of Philadelphia as he's headed back down to D.C. And he knows what there's anarchists right now as political parties, and he knows what he's watched Europe, and he's seen the peril that Europe has put itself in by this class, this broad class. Stratification of their societies. And so, to me, we're headed down that path of we've allowed nations like Mexico, like China, to steal our industry. We haven't protected it, right? And so, and what we offer our citizens is you're going to be a service worker, or you're going to be a teller or something, because all the other jobs in this country that used to support families in factories were union jobs, had pensions, defined benefit pensions, like Ford and IBM. Those are gone.
Yeah, but Tim, but Mac, I think you're right, but it's much more organized. I mean, look at what happened when that stuff started. In the late part of the 19th century in Europe, and eventually migrated to the United States. You had massive bombing attacks and everything turn of the century, all the way up to 1921. You know, you were having some of the biggest bombs that were ever set off. Mass murder in New York was over that stuff you just mentioned, that anarch stuff. Mm-hmm. But then, when we went through the Depression, we went through World War II, and then in the Vietnam era, these kids have been going to school, and each generation of college professors is getting more and more left. To the point where
more left leaning
going towards the
I don't know.
In the
60s, they were pretty left leaning, Jeff.
That's what I'm saying. They got even worse.
No, in the 60s, you still had faculty members who would admit they're in the Republican Party, and in most your major universities, not a lot, but they were still there.
But after that, remember the SDS guys? Those guys, the weathermen setting off bombs.
Right.
A lot of the robbing armored cars, killing cops. Some of those assholes are professors now. A lot of them.
I don't know if I'm believing that. I'm having a tough time with
that.
Who's that? Bill Ayers. Barack Obama's buddy Bill Ayers. He admitted that he was guilty as hell when he got off, and his plan explicitly called for it. I mean, they wrote this stuff down, murdering about 23 million people who wouldn't go along with the program. They would talk about that stuff as if it was inconsequential. No, just look up Bill Ayers and Google him. And I would submit to you, because Jeff is right, that the AOC is a product of our university system, and I screwed this up last week, so let me do this quote again. The best argument against democracy would be a 5-minute conversation with it. Right there. Boom. This obviously isn't going to work if this is what you've got running the damn thing. But it's what's frightening is that people read that fantasy of hers and give it credence. It's frightening.
But let me just say, there is nobody that is running to her. I mean, to me, there's a little bit of hysteria going on here, boys.
Yeah, but every major presidential candidate for the Democrats signed up for it. And did you see that tape of those school kids confronting Dianne Feinstein?
Yeah.
Your senior senator?
All of them. Like,
yeah.
Like,
and so
they're little kids. What do you want? They parrot what they see on TV, and she's all over the TV. So, of course, they would parrot her. Does that have anything to do with what we would do as a nation?
I think the adults that are teaching those kids, I think it does.
I really think it does. And because that's what's coming behind the generation that we have right now that everybody's bitching about. But that's, of course, normal. Yeah. Everybody always bitches about the younger generation. Right. But they're weird. You got to admit that.
They're always weird, though.
They're just not educated anymore. That's the thing. They just don't know shit. I mean, I'm talking they don't know basic math. They don't know grammar. Read the stuff they write. You know,
they wouldn't know what the hell Iwo Jima is or what it meant or what year it occurred.
That's over the line.
I mean, this is stuff that we knew as kids. You know, we could have told you who the major antagonists were in the Civil War, for crying out loud. And I bet Jeff could have been naming division commanders. He's like that. But all kids our age could do that. We all had that common knowledge.
All kids our age could have done what?
I don't think kids today, if you asked them what Iwo Jima, what was the Battle of Iwo Jima? Who fought? When did it happen? I don't think they could tell you. I don't think they could tell you who fought.
I think most of my friends might have said, well, I know it was part of World War II. That would have been the extent that my friends would have known.
Right. Well, my friends would have known that we fought the Japanese in World War II.
Yeah, but I went on field trips to Gettysburg as a third grader, so we kind of had a little Civil War because I was, you know, Annapolis, Maryland. It was right there in the midst of it, so that was relatively common knowledge amongst kids that I grew up with.
Tim, but, I'll never forget you teaching the lieutenants at Antietam saying, "Now over here, you had the McClellan's forces there, the Iron Brigade, Irish Brigade, and over there you had the Sons of Treason coming across the sunken road." The Sons of Treason, they're Confederates.
My great-great-grandfather came across that cornfield in Antietam. I don't, you know, it's amazing he survived that damn thing. So I had a particular view, I must admit.
The my guests on the All Conspiracy Radio Hour are Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenney. We chartered a black helicopter. We're beating that up. I think she sucks the air out of the room, much like Donald Trump does. Okay. And so, I mean, and I don't, unless you get the media and what the media pays attention to and what's truly important in the United States confused. And if you do get those confused, then you're stupid. I don't see her as anything substantive relative to American politics. I will say this though. To me, Donald Trump is testament to the dissatisfaction of what used to be a hopeful American middle class. He got elected by them. A middle class that is pissed. And it's getting pissed because every year it gets told, we understand what you're going through, we understand what you feel. And every year there's worse and worse economic news. And this to me is just stupid. There's more and more regulation of American business, so we regulate away, you know, jobs.
Right.
And come on, at some point, knock it off. Man, we've got to put people to work. And now all of a sudden Trump comes in and he says, hey, we're doing away with these regulations. And I'll tell you this, if he does the deal with China, right, and if he can make that work, you know, our economy will go through the roof with what he's done already. I mean, that's my opinion. And I tend to be right on these kind of things. So
I think you're right now, Mac. I think the reason they want to control the colleges like this is they don't want to have an honest debate where that type of stuff comes out because they'll lose. And that's why they're so hell-bent on controlling what happens in the colleges. You can't go there and speak, you know, conservatively anymore without somebody coming and punching you, you know. And of course, if you defend yourself, then somehow they'll say it's your fault. Now, I think you're right. I think that if that message is allowed to come out, the way FDR's stupid fireside chats that didn't make any sense came out, then maybe, you know, things would change even quicker.
Yeah, but you've also got the, you know, there's going to be a significant amount of automation taking over tasks that people do within the next 10 years.
That's the latest.
All the jobs disappearing because of automation.
That's the latest. That's the latest helicopter that Timmy's chartered. Okay, so
I'm telling you, you've got to think about it.
You got to think about it.
I mean, once they automate trucks,
how do you automate trucks? How do you have trucks killing people? How do you automate that?
They are getting better. Of course, they have them right now and whatnot. And I think the first thing you're going to see, and I will bet you money within 10 years, is trucks doing the main freeways. When they get into certain collection centers, humans get behind to navigate through the streets and deliver the loads and whatnot. But a truck driver can only drive when he's interstate 14 hours a day max, and a computer can drive 24, dude. It's just that simple.
And I can see Thaddeus.
How do you fly drones? How do you fly drones in Afghanistan from Crete Air Force Base? Same damn thing.
They're not killing anybody in the sky, though.
Well, see, I understand.
When that truck, rolls over.
The question is, can the technology get better? And if you look at the growth of technology, which seems to be like a pretty exponential, I'm betting technology gets better, and there's a gigantic financial incentive to do that. Yeah. And it's going to happen. How long do you think you're going to need humans in McDonald's? I mean, when particularly in places like Seattle, where it's a $15 minimum wage, they're already doing away with most of the humans there.
Yeah.
I don't have an answer for any of that. No, I do understand automation has been doing that for eons, right? And even so, when we say Harley Davidson or Harley Davidson is probably a bad example, but somebody's going to build a new plant in Sheboygan, Wisconsin, it ain't going to be your grandpa's plant, all right? It's going to be something else. And that plant that gets built is going to have a ton of automation in it, and it's so the people that are going to get hired to work in the plant are going to tend to the robots and the technology. They're not going to be putting windshields in cars.
So but that's been a conundrum since
the guy with a pile of horseshoes, the blacksmith, saying, "What the fuck am I going to do now?" When he watches the Model T's driving down the street in 1907, he's thinking, "What the fuck am I going to do now?" Well, he becomes a mechanic, you know.
So you're selling me the little engine that could. There will always be another job. It will always be well paying. And Mac, you're overreacting all this.
No, I'm
overreacting. I don't know if you are.
No, but the jobs that will be to service the automation, which are technical skills that are technical college, community college level skills. That's where the job market's going to shift.
And I'm going to tell you that is fodder for the revolution, my friend.
Well, that's what I was just going to say, because the elite colleges and whatnot, what they're teaching, I mean, anybody getting a degree with studies behind it, it's a worthless degree.
Right.
What they're putting out, with the exception of the hard science graduates, is unemployable permanent service workers.
And that's
going to cause a problem. Yeah.
You have to have people who know how to fix those robots. And they're not going to get it in women's studies or fucking, you know, human sexuality. They're going to have to know how to do shit.
No, it's the technical and community colleges, their day is coming. I mean that's their business. My wife is in, and that's what they're thinking. They are looking well ahead and recognizing what the needs are going to be, in conjunction with local business, because nobody wants to work with universities now. I mean, comedians won't even go there. Bands won't go there. Nobody wants to go there. It's a place of misery because of the studies departments.
I don't know that that's accurate, but. There's still a lot of money.
I'm going based off of media. In the media I consume with
here we go.
Accurate. I have to admit that.
Here we go. All right. Go ahead, Jeff. You were going to say something?
No, I wasn't.
You weren't?
The one thing I'd say, though, you know, along those lines with the schools, the schools don't teach anything except indoctrination. It's basically you learn the religion, but you don't learn how to do anything. And like Tim was saying, I mean, I had one of my kids, instead of using his GI Bill to go to college, he went and he learned how to do fifth echelon maintenance. You know, he can work at a nuclear power plant, or he can work on, you know, avionics for jets. And he makes good money. And he started making it immediately when he got out of that school. And consequently, you know, you get a lot of these kids that are, they're waiting on tables, you know, in restaurants in the big cities. You say, well, the kid's got a master's degree, and let's see, well, he's an English major, and then he specialized, you know, in women's literature or something like that, and now, look, he can't do shit. Nobody wants to hire him because they're not doing anything. That was his degree anyway, unless he works for a political campaign.
And if you're a decent welder in this part of the country, brother, your base salary is around $120,000, and that's just getting started. Particularly if you work in building ships or out in the oil patch. I mean, a competent welder now, not just a guy that can run a bead. I mean, a guy that knows what he's doing. A journeyman welder is a rich man in Texas.
That's a good idea for a book, Tim. A Rich Man in Texas.
Yeah. I wouldn't know anything about that. Or well,
I mean,
unfortunately.
The idea is great, though, you know?
Yeah. No, well said, sir. That is true.
Yeah, look, I'm not a big fan of much of what goes on at, and again, there's no doubt that liberal America controls education. I don't know that I would react to the extent that both of you two Cro-Magnons have reacted. So I would put myself left of you.
I would too.
But no, that's a fair one.
That's the reason I don't like you, though, Mac.
You got to keep in mind there's this phenomenon called the intellectual dark web that has like the Weinstein brothers, some very famous academic guys, and Dave Rubin and Joe Rogan gets in there, and of course this guy, the guy from Jordan Peterson from Canada, the most, you know, popular writer in the world right now, and these guys constantly beat the very drum that Jeff is beating right now. And these guys are academics; they're all out of the university, and they are saying essentially the exact same thing. And we'll concede that in most university campuses, a guy can go and get a business degree and not have to deal with a whole lot of politically correct nonsense. He's going to have to deal with some, brother. He's going to have to attend some of these weird classes, particularly at the Ivy League. And right now, as I pointed out last week, within our current media environment, expressing seething hatred for white males is absolutely okay. And those guys are going to catch some of that too.
Yeah, but who cares unless you're a white male?
No, I don't care. I mean, I'm a white male and don't care. I'm just saying that the navigating the college campus for your ravaged, cisgendered, good, decent guy, the kind of kid we want to see come in the Marine Corps, is difficult now, unless you're in one of the, you know, off the coasts and in the interior in a smaller state or university. That's all I'm saying.
Anything that calls itself higher learning that encourages or at least doesn't prohibit the idea of holding somebody's ethnicity, no matter what ethnicity they are, or their gender, just for the fact that they are it, i.e. white men, you can easily shift that fire over to something else. Black women, right. Chinese women, right. You know, Middle Eastern men. If you let one prejudice thing go, it's easy to shift fires over.
You know,
half the commies in Germany in the 1930s ended up as Nazis killing people left, right, and center in the 1940s.
And that's exactly the point. Why do we tolerate that? Because racism is racism is racism, you know? And right now, you know, we get hammered in the public sphere, in the intellectual access to the elite institution sphere, it's the Asian Americans getting hammered. And they're getting hammered hard. And it's not right. It's not American, you know? And it's encouraged and indulged in popular society. And that is why there's so many people on the internet who dedicate their entire, you know, internet time career in fighting exactly this on campus. I think it's worse than you might suspect, Matt, But then again, I have to admit, I don't personally know. I just follow these guys and find what they say compelling.
Right.
Victor Davis Hanson, you should read some of his stuff in that. He's a smart, well thought out guy. Not like me, for sure. No, but he's got his shit together.
And what does he say? His
best article was on the crew, man. Just exactly what Jeff and I were talking about 2 weeks ago. And notice we don't even bring it up because we don't want to be, we don't want to be rubbing anybody's noses in it. But did we not talk about that about a week before Hanson wrote that that excellent article? And it's excellent.
Yeah. But the whole thing is like Jesse Smollett thing. It's schadenfreude for me because, one stupid accusation of these supposed hate crime after another turns out to be a amateurish hoax.
Right.
You know, the thing with the kids in front of the Lincoln Memorial from the Catholic school, you know, the thing with Smollett, it's just stupid, you know, bubbles easily popped.
And when it does go south, what does the New York Times do? I'll answer my own question. They bring up Emmett Till, I think this month now, 279 times. Do you know what I'm talking about when I say Emmett Till?
Yeah, from like the 50s.
Right. 67 years ago, a horrible hate crime to do a black teenager lynched because they said he winked at a white woman. I mean, absolutely horrible. But also something that hasn't happened in 67 years. And why you want to bring that up and try to relate it to what's going on now if you don't want to bring up Tawana Brawley, which would be a much better historical example to bring up in this case?
Because you don't want to bring up Tawana Brawley because you're trying to find a way out of your behavior, right? Again, what we know is it's astounding when people do the postmortems on these things that the most basic elements of journalism are thrown out the window, and what's important is, right, it's confrontational and you get it out there quick. That's, when you have companies like the Washington Post and the New York Times printing retractions at the rate they print them now, it's amazing. They're supposed to be, right, the gold standard of a news media. It's a joke. And that girl who was on with Mike Britlin, Laura, whatever her name is, I mean, she laid the wood to him. And I think she obviously speaks the truth, but it's not going to change anything. Like, okay, so what if she's right? Who gives a shit? What we answer to is our shareholders, right? We're making more money than we've ever been being the party of opposition to Donald Trump, right? Every day, the New York Times, the Washington Post, we're on the forefront of this fight against this president, and it is doing nothing but increasing our circulation, increasing our clicks, and increasing our revenue. Boom. What else can I do for you today?
Well, I mean,
hey, man, I want to bring up something that I sent you earlier in the day, Mac, an example of some excellent journalistic work out of ProPublica, you know, a very left-wing a liberal place. And it's an article on the Fitzgerald incident.
Because,
and, man, does it have some good graphics in it. And it's a well-balanced, well-researched article, excellent journalism. I just wanted to recommend that.
Whoa.
At least people think that they don't read stuff like this.
Whoa.
I read everything. excellent graphics. It's well worth taking the time to look through.
Well, that's interesting.
Well, yeah, there's like the whole Thomas Nast thing back during the days of Boss Tweed in New York City. Super corrupt Tammany Hall. And this guy, you know, fearless with these cartoons, because a lot of the constituents couldn't really read, you know, basically brought the guy down. And that's honest journalism there. Of course, then you got 50 years later, you have, you know, William Randolph Hearst basically concocting reason for us to go into the Spanish-American War. You know, and so these are humans. And the fact that when they're going through their journalism training, they don't have that, it's not being driven into them that this has to be an accurate story. It can't be biased. You know, that's not happening. You know, that's just not happening. There's only one opinion that's tolerated in most universities. And it's not a doctor's view of where the doctor's Hippocratic Oath should be, where he is there to do at first do no harm. That should be, in a journalistic way, their tenet, right. too.
No,
I'm not going to ever do inaccuracies, and for sure I'm not going to deliberately lie. But that's not the case. It's too volatile of a weapon.
And you've also got the omission part of it. Now, I'm going to ask a question of Jeff, and I bet he knows it, which is, what was the largest lynching in America ever? Where did it happen? And who was
lynched? I think it was New Orleans. I think it was a bunch of Italians who were hung by the citizens of New Orleans after the murder of the police chief, Irish police chief.
That's exactly right. How did I know you would know? March 4th, 1891, Sicilian specific.
You paid me 30 minutes ago. No, I just knew.
And there was mob involved, so I know that you were doing what that. But my point being, I don't think your average African American's a studies major would have any idea of that. Because that is the kind of information that you're never going to read in this day and age as they start talking about our history and how we've evolved from where we once were. You see what I'm saying? Because we were in a bad place racially, relations-wise, but it wasn't just the blacks. In New Orleans, it was definitely the Sicilians. In the Northeast, it was the Irish for a while. I mean, everybody's had their turn being the turd in the punch bowl, but nobody seems to understand that because we don't seem to want to teach an honest, comprehensive history. We want a set of assumptions that we're going to cherry pick our history in order to validate these assumptions, and that does nobody any favors whatsoever.
I will have to say, I used to hear my grandmother talking about the Irish and the way the Irish got treated. Okay, I don't think though that I would confuse that with the way blacks have been treated in this country. The length of the severity, the Irish were capable because of skin. I would say because of skin pigmentation. To get out of that, where blacks were not. And so, while I understand your point about the largest lynching, I don't know. To me, I don't know what I'm trying to say here.
No.
Well, most of the lynching's not uncommon because, especially in the frontier, because you just didn't have access to courts. And so, a lot of people were hung unjustly, but a lot of people were hung unjustly who deserved to be hung. And, you just didn't have that much law. And yet you still had people out there in communities.
And I'm not saying the Irish American or the Italian American experience was anything like the intensity of the Black American experience. There were places and times when they were discriminated against just as the blacks were under Jim Crow. But in no way, shape, or form am I trying to imply that they're just the same. They're clearly different. My point is that if you understand how we evolved and got to the place we are, it helps to understand what the hell's happening around you. And our academic system intentionally avoids topics like this. They don't discuss these kinds of things. They focus exclusively on how bad we were to the indigenous people and the African Americans and nothing else. And that's bullshit because that's not how our society functions. That wasn't us.
That's right. The truth is this. Every country on earth has had slaves. Yet there's only one country that I know of that fought one of the top 10 bloodiest wars in history in order to end that condition for a race that wasn't them. And so it's like, even though it's a bad thing, the way it ended is heroic because 360,000 people in the North and probably about 250,000 Southerners died over that situation. And nobody else, the only reason it ended in other countries is because economically stupid. Better to give a guy a miserable pittance and let him think he's free, even though he depends on you for his livelihood, than it is to have to own the guy like he's a horse or something.
Can I make a point here? I know Tim. Yeah. Go ahead, Tim. You make your point.
No, I just wanted to add that the British were a little bit ahead of us in the game at tremendous financial cost to themselves. On moral grounds, they decided we're going to eradicate the slave trade across the Atlantic. for no other reason than it was morally wrong to treat fellow humans that way, and that never happened in the history of mankind ever. Ever has that happened. But until the Brits did it, and then we went ahead and did it ourselves. That's all I wanted to say.
The act prohibiting the importation of slaves in 1807 is a United States federal law that stated that no new slaves were permitted or imported in the United States. It took effect in 1808. Now, I was looking for was I did this, and I was surprised at what I found. So if you look at the slave trade in the world, right, and the chronology of it, you know, what nation do you think was the first nation to outlaw slavery?
Oh, jeez.
Yeah.
I would have guessed the United Kingdom.
Well, I want to say that the United Kingdom prohibited the international movement of slaves. They did not outlaw slavery, so you could not move them, but you could still own them, right? And so when you go through the chronology, it's pretty interesting who did what when, right? And so so in this whole march up to the American Civil War, right, like, for instance, in 1792, when coincidentally, Columbus sailed the ocean blue. Denmark banned the import of slaves.
Oh, 1792. 1792 is when we did the Constitution.
You're right. My bad. Denmark bans the import of slaves to its West Indies colonies, although the law only took effect in 1803. So you have these things, right, that get enacted. Right. In 1807, Britain passes the Abolition of Slave Trade Act, outlawing British Atlantic slave trade. Right. It does not outlaw slavery, though. Right. The United States follows suit in 1808. In 1811, Spain abolishes slavery, including in its colonies, although Cuba rejected the ban and continued to deal in slaves. So Spain is actually the first nation that abolishes slavery. In 1813, Sweden bans slave trading, but not slavery. The Netherlands bans slave trading. So it's very interesting. In 1833, Britain abolishes the Slavery Act, or the Abolition of Slavery Act, ordering gradual abolition of slavery in all British colonies. Colonies. Plantation owners in the West Indies received £20 million in compensation. So it's real. I thought it was very interesting, right? So in a world with a few exceptions, it's still legal to own slaves, right? And to include in Britain. In 1848, France abolishes slavery. 1851, Brazil abolishes slavery, right? In 1858, Portugal abolishes slavery. In 1861, the Netherlands abolishes slavery. So you can see the United States is flailing with this, right? Is flailing with this. But at the time, right, of the debate, it's still an open question in the world whether, you know, you can own black people or not. So
yeah, and what that did was similar to prohibition. It made the illegal importation of slave trade very lucrative. Right.
Thing
in the 1830s and 40s and 50s.
Right. So, anyway. But see, here's my point in all of this is it is the unvarnished discussion, and I use the Confederate memorials example once again, and that is it would be far better for the nation to leave the memorial standing and for people that study it to understand that they were initially prohibited after the Civil War. That they were only allowed after much discussion about binding the wounds of the nation, right? And so I think that's an important point that people should understand.
Yeah, I agree.
Right, and also I think right next to that statue ought to be right within 2 miles of where you're standing, 40,000 black human beings were sold at these places in our city. You can go and you can see the walls, you can see the buildings, you can see this. This is the tradition of our county, and this is the complete unvarnished history of it. And I think that's much, and then you have a discussion about that. Like, how could we do that? Why did we do that? How did they live? And that's, to me, the way the United States ought to treat that stuff in an open society that doesn't run from its history and doesn't try to bleach it. And to me, what we're doing is we're bleaching our history, and we're not going to look at it because we don't want to confront. Even Lincoln. Lincoln's quotes, what is the phraseology? If I can maintain the Union and I must free all the slaves, I will do that. If I can preserve the Union. If in order to preserve the Union, I have to free all the slaves, I will do that. But I will
preserve. The Union is the important thing.
Right, I will preserve the Union. Now, that does not sound like the great emancipator to me. But, right, that is the
president.
Right. That is the mythology that's grown up around Lincoln. And when you look at Lincoln's quotes leading up to his presidency and in those debates, right? You tell me, you know, if he ran as the great emancipator. I mean, he was certainly a polarizing figure. What's even funnier is get into a discussion with Democrats who don't know a whole lot about history and tell them that the Democrats were the party of slavery. They have a conniption fit.
And the party of Jim Crow.
Oh, my God. Dixiecrats. Exactly. All of it.
Now, the Dinesh D'Souza's had a $100,000 bet out if anybody can find one example of a Republican who owned slaves. And I believe the one example was that, like, Grant's a wife's dad owned slaves, but he was a Democrat, so that didn't count. Hey, you know, when you talk about, you know, the healing wounds, it brought up a funny story. You guys, of course, remember old David Hyde from TBS, right?
Yes.
So David, his dad was a physician, I believe, and they were driven up to Ohio, I think, to look at the Football Hall of Fame or some kind of sports-related thing like that. And on the way back, he diverted through to this little town in Ohio. His dad had a map out, and he found this cemetery, and he goes, come on, boy, we got to do this. And they went and they pissed on a grave with a Union officer that hit his great-great-grandfather in the head with a sword butt and knocked him daffy at the end of the Civil War. He goes, boy, we got to do this. I mean, they drove like 200 miles out of their way. I thought it was the funniest damn thing, but I certainly understood it. I mean, today kids would probably think you're crazy if you told them that story.
Yeah. Dave High, yep. Yeah. He's a funny guy.
On March 22nd, 2007, all right, Britain marks 200 years on March 25th since it enacted a law banning the transatlantic slave trade, right? And it, comma, although full abolition of slavery did not follow for another generation. How long is a generation? 70 years?
No, it's been like
30
years.
All right, so sometime prior to probably 1850, England, Britain, banned slavery. But you can see, I mean, it's a contemporary discussion, a contemporary issue. And so when you say, right, and I remember this, when I actually looked this up, you know, Jefferson, Washington, right, excoriated because they were slave owners. The whole world owned slaves. Right?
Whole world in America, except,
right. North. Washington frees his, what, upon his wife's death, after he dies and his wife dies, or his wife frees him, and then Jefferson frees his slaves. So these were leading men of their times, and they freed their slaves, you know, upon their death. I mean, which was looked at as a noble thing, and atypical for that time, because you tended to pass that property to your children, so they wouldn't have to incur the cost of buying their own. And so, to me, it's like we want to compare these guys to us right now. And if you look at them as a, you know, the greatest power in the world, which was Britain, slavery was legal. In every other great power, slavery was legal. And these guys emancipated their slaves upon their death, or the death of their wife, and we shit on them because they owned slaves. So to me, this discussion that's kind of morphed into what has become, you know, your guys bitching at the start of this, right, are educational institutions not open to discussing the truth in a liberal arts way, right, where you can talk about all of it and have a measured quality discussion. And I think it threatens the democracy at some point when it becomes so bad and where the truth is no longer relevant. It's doubled down by a media who doesn't give a shit about the truth. And I that scares me. What does that look like in 50 years?
Yeah, well, you know, it's psychologists who work with patients who are suffering depression or delusions or whatnot try to get them out of modes of thinking which are incorrect. I mean, because, you know, thinking in catastrophic terms, thinking that this is going to harm them, thinking that things like words and whatnot have the power to completely discombobulate you, and you've got to protect yourself with them. That's the thinking of somebody who's not mentally sane. I mean, technically, and this is what they're teaching people, for crying out loud. And I agree with you. It's a disservice to the country for sure. But it's not a good service to the individuals that are being on the receiving end of this indoctrination. Mother Nature's very, very harsh and demanding, but demanding master, and nobody cares how you feel about most shit most of the time in most places.
Right. I mean, to me, education, and especially, I mean, if you want to hear some interesting discussions, you should hear, I mean, if we doubled the audience with our friends, right, and all smart guys, all unafraid to have an opinion and unafraid to let it rip. I love that. One of the things I love about the whole post-traumatic winning thing is getting the thoughts of my friends and say, hey, Mac, have you ever thought of this? Hey, I like this, but I have this to say about that. The ensemble creativity that my friends contribute to the nation's defense, to post-traumatic winning, is one of the things I've always loved about this fraternity I joined at the basic school and then as an instructor at IOC. They're incredible guys, and this honest intellectual endeavor that we're a part of is always something I've loved. And to think that when it's institutionally biased against that bugs me. That bugs me. But we're done. We're done. So nobody say another fucking word. All right. My guests today have been Jeff Kenny and Tim Lynch. Boys, thank you very much for the visit, the entire wild ride of it. And we will do this again next week. Have a great day.
You too, Mac.
See you later. More of Allmarine Radio coming up next on your home for it, the All Warrior Radio Network.
Hi, this is Tim McGarry from the McGarry Mortgage Minute. Heard every Wednesday right here on Allmarine Radio, where I'll answer all your mortgage questions from home buying to home financing, from VA to conventional loans to moving in. So don't miss it. The McGarry Mortgage Minute, right here on Allmarine Radio, on the All Warrior Radio Network. And remember, my name is McGarry, and I'm here to help.
Find all of Tim McGarry's contact information on the ReadBoard page at AllmarineRadio.com.
We all have the ability to touch the lives of those around us. Moms, dads, neighbors, teachers, friends. These are the people who are always there to listen when we need to talk. Though their actions may not always be monumental, they are always felt. To someone going through a difficult time, a text, a call, or a visit can mean so much. Reach out to the veterans in your life today. Let them know they're not alone. One simple act can make all the difference. That's the power of one. If you're a veteran in crisis or know one who is, visit veteranscrisisline.net for free 24/7 confidential support. Or call 1-800-273-8255 and press 1.
I'm good, but I have a story and I don't know where to start.
I'm good, but I feel alone in a crowd.
I'm good, but the past keeps coming back.
When the service member or veteran in your life says,
I'm good.
Are you really listening?
I'm good, but I can't get out of bed.
I'm good.
and I can't sleep.
I'm good, but I feel overwhelmed.
I'm good, but I don't feel safe.
I'm good, but I still have nightmares. I'm good, but I don't need any help. I'm good, but I don't feel anything anymore.
I'm good, but I can't live like this anymore.
I'm really not so good. But are you ready to listen?
Suicide prevention is everyone's responsibility. Listen to the veteran or service member in your life. If you are in crisis or know someone who is, call the Veterans Crisis Line and Military Crisis Line at 1-800-273-8255 and press 1 for free 24/7 confidential support.
All you veterans, listen up. This is Bob Nielsen, former Marine and founder of 100 Entrepreneurs Project. Turner Construction is looking for veterans with real-world leadership experience to join their team of professionals.
Hold on, Nielsen. Are we talking about a job or a career?
Matt, Turner Construction is a great company with global opportunities for veteran leaders who are looking to start professional careers. I know. I returned to Turner after I got back from Vietnam and retired after 50 years. I had a great career traveling the world leading teams of Turner employees as we built incredible projects.
Are they looking for me to have construction experience, Bob?
Absolutely not. Turner's looking for leaders who have led under pressure. We want leadership. So if you're led in Iraq or Afghanistan or any other contingency, Turner Construction is actively looking for you.
So, a career with competitive pay, good benefits, and a company seeking veteran leaders. That's what we're talking about.
Bingo. We're on the right road when a grunt can understand it. Good job, Mac.
I appreciate that there, Nielsen. How do I get the ball rolling? What do I do?
Just email your resume to jobs@allmarineradio.com, and I will personally contact you and we'll begin the process.
I love it. Turner Construction is looking for veteran leaders who are looking for careers to join their veteran-friendly team. Email Bob Nielsen at jobs@allmarineradio.com. Let's do it.
America's injured and critically ill service members face incredible challenges every day of their lives. Since 2004, the Semper Fi Fund has helped thousands of service members and their families with both immediate and long-term needs. Join the Semper Fi Fund in supporting American heroes. They've given so much. Now it's our turn. Learn how your tax-deductible donation makes a real difference in their lives at SemperFiFund.org.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
You know you want me to sing it. I know you want me to sing it.
With a short little note, said I had a good time. It was written in lipstick red. She didn't sign her name, I wonder. That's a little secret that she knew. She's walking around in my sleep. Dream walking, little talking. She's calling my name again.
Hey, all right, enough of that. Let me, the Blockhead Brothers. Nice. let me read you some email. From Ohio, man. They are right. From somebody else. These guys are so wrong. Where did you find these two? Oh, my God. Where did you find these two? They're friends of mine. Another one. As an econ major, all caps, you should know that when technology frees up labor, that labor is available to be applied in other areas, increasing overall productivity and quality of life. Yes, there is a local pain felt by individuals during the transition. Oh, my God. The mistake you make, being a non-econ major, is that you assume right, that other similar opportunities are available.
Between dreams and memories, I'll be losing my mind till she comes back to me.
Dream walking.
Yeah, that's the mistake. That's the mistake. The jobs haven't stayed here. Okay? They've gone bye-bye. Now, you're telling me that, okay, then, if you don't get a college degree, then that's the fate you suffer? And if that's your position, okay, got it. You're going to have a pretty pissed-off electorate, because guess what? Everybody who doesn't want to go to college. And so everybody who doesn't go to college is relegated to the service industry. And don't tell me about free trade, because there ain't nothing free about it. The predatory practices that China and Mexico, give me a break. Mexico, look, if I was the United States, I'd say, look, these are the costs that our manufacturers incur. We have an EPA. That means you can't dump chemicals everywhere. We have a thing called OSHA, which means workers have rights. Okay, we estimate that costs our producers in this industry, right, this amount of money for every employee. So you are gonna feel a tariff of that. That's our overhead to manufacture in our country. Okay, now, if you can do it cheaper and ship it, given that overhead, but we're not about letting a company move its production facility across the border in order to avoid our regulation and then you to be able to ship that product back inside our country. We ain't having that. That ain't right. That isn't fair. So that's the ceiling. That's the floor. You come in with these costs associated, none of which you bear in your country. None of which. Because you're a backwards country. Anyway. Yeah, that's, to me, the bigger issue is the evaporation of the middle class. That's a big issue. That's a big issue. Now, I was told, Brookings Institute. I was told that the Brookings Institute had written some interesting stuff about the middle class. The Future of the Middle Class Initiative Project. How about that? Series, The American Upper Middle Class. Topic, middle class. All right. Brookings Institute, The Future of the Middle Class Initiative. The goal of the Future of the Middle Class Initiative is to improve the quality of life of America's middle class and to increase the number of people rising to join its ranks. Through independent, nonpartisan analysis and policy development, we seek to advance public understanding of challenges facing the middle class and barriers to upward mobility. Boom. Right? So here's a few of the articles that have been written about the middle class. Number one, renting the American dream. Why home ownership shouldn't be a prerequisite for middle class financial security. Two, why are out of work men so unhappy in the United States? Number three, men without work. Number four, no room at the top, the stark divide in black and white economic mobility. So interesting topics, right? Right? Here's another article. The American upper middle class, not just the 1%, upper middle class income separation. So, looks like a statistical article. Yeah. So to me, yeah, I was told that Brookings, actually John Allen, a friend of mine, told me about this middle class initiative that Brookings was going to get after. So I will endeavor to have somebody on from Brookings to talk about that. Anyway, so I find that interesting. But to me, that's a huge issue in this country. Because once there's, you see people like that we're seeing in Congress with radical ideas of socialism. Why? Because capitalism doesn't work for them. Or at least that's their perception. It doesn't work for me. Right? I don't see upward mobility. I don't see my path to a better paying job. I don't see any path to a retirement for me. And, you know, and the United States has to answer that. They have to answer the bell on that. Right? Do we have to create economic incentives for companies to have defined benefit plans? Because the 401k is just a way to lay it on the employee and not fund it. That, truth be told. Oh, yeah, we have a retirement plan. It's a 401k. So that means if you don't contribute, we don't contribute. Which means, and we're not paying you enough, that if you have kids, you can contribute, so you won't be able to contribute, which means we don't have to. But we can blame you. The onus is on you. That's how that works. Defined benefit plan, I got to put money away for you every payday. Every payday. Ohio man, he's on fire today. Like, what's up with that guy? What is up with that guy? I am a fellow econ major. Whoops. Then how could you screw that up? Ohio man, what is going on? This might be a cry for help. I think this might be a cry for help. I just deleted that too. Where the hell is it? Shit. What the hell, man? Where does it go? If I sideswipe it, does that mean I archive it? Where's my mail archive? I don't even know. Spam. It's not spam. It's not in trash. I just checked trash. Starred. Snoozed. Sent. Drafts. I'm lost in this. I'm lost in my email. I don't know what happened. Yeah, so I'm shocked. Yeah, I see that as a bigger threat to the country. I see it as a bigger threat to the country than, you know, the wackadoodles in our university system. I mean, they've been doing that for a long time. It's not like there was ever, you know, a huge concern. Well, I take that back. When I was in college, back in the late 70s and early 80s, you know, there were a lot of veterans teaching on campus, right? A lot of veterans that had fought were in their 60s teaching college, and you'd bump into them. And there was always the liberals, or, I mean, come on, it's education. But to me, the igniter of all this is, look, when you see a path that takes you, you know, down the road of life and that you could live a quality life, but I think more and more you see people that, you know, first of all, the amount of money that people pay in large cities to live is ridiculous. And that's not going to change. in where are the manufacturing sector has gone away. The jobs that have replaced the manufacturing sector don't support families, right? Two people have to work now, maybe more than two jobs. Are those are all negatives on the wheel of life, right? Dad used to work for Ford Aerospace in Irvine. He had a defined benefit, you know, retirement, and we had good health insurance. All that has gone away. We have bare bones medical insurance with large copays, and we have a 401k plan that we can't contribute to because we have three kids. So we don't know how we're going to retire. And I would say, that covers a lot of people in this country. A lot of people in this country. Now, the answer to that is, well, they should move. That's right. They should move. They should go someplace else. They should find a better job that has better benefits. And then they should live the life that they want to. But guess what? Not that many people do that. Not that many people do that. And so it's a problem. It's a problem. Again, not just for a few. So how do people like that AOC woman, how do they get such a following? You combine those two things. You combine an education system that's left-leaning with a middle class that loses economic hope. So, And that's the great fallacy of this. You know, I remember seeing Orrin Hatch, and I just like, ugh, my God, Orrin, are you kidding me? You know, when the president kind of started talking about tariffs, right, I think what people should have said is, look, I'm all for the economic confrontation we should have had a long time ago with China. But what Orrin Hatch says is, anytime free trade is disrupted, I'm concerned as a free trade guy. It's not free trade. If you think that's free trade, I have some oceanfront property in Kansas I want to sell you, you rube. You know, it's just stupid. Right? And these are the people that lead our country. How exciting is that? Ugh, my God. Another email. Mac, what's the latest from Kashmir? You know, good question. I wonder what you get when you type in hashtag Kashmir. All right, here you have it. The latest. Let's see. Indian government and military forces attend to the scene of a downed F-21. UN Resolution 96, India and Pakistan should work for a peaceful settlement, continue to observe a ceasefire, and accept the principle of a cession of Kashmir should be determined by a free and impartial plebiscite under the auspices of the UN. Here's an interesting news report. All right, there's an extremely heavy flying of fighter jets going on along the LOC, whatever LOC is. I assume it's that line, the line of something. Both Pakistani Air Force and Indian Air Force are facing each other, although Indian Air Force is staying far away from the LOC. Next 48 hours is crucial. Anything can happen. It's anyway. So that's going on. That's the latest. Is that there's a tense standoff in the region. So we'll see. We'll see if anybody goes there. We'll see if anybody goes there. But yeah, two pretty robust powers that if they want to go there, they certainly can. Oops. That'll do it on a Wednesday. If you're just tuning in, India and Pakistan are getting after each other. Always interesting to watch other countries do this. So we've been kind of keeping an eye on that a little bit. And the aviation maniacs are astounded that an F-21, a MiG-21, I'm sorry, would take on an F-16. With the expected outcome of, yeah, MiG-21 loses. And so you're seeing an Iranian, what they say is a squadron commander being paraded around, being detained by Pakistani fighters. So that in the news. Tim Lynch and Jeff Kenny joined me. We talked about Scott Cuomo's article, and then we talk about, and then as typical, right, they charter the black helicopters and they get them going. And as always, I try to add some sense of intellectual dignity and rigor to it, which fails most of the time. So they join me today. But anyway, have a great day. Tomorrow, Grant Newsham's going to join us. So, president in Vietnam, meeting with Mr. Kim. Chairman Kim, whatever we call that dude. So they're in Vietnam. So we'll see if anything comes out of that. I think people are looking for something that will give it impetus to go further, but everybody's skeptical. North Koreans don't seem to want to come to the table first, right? And we'll see what the United States does. So, but I will tell you this. I said this a while ago. 2 years ago? North Korea was shooting missiles, right, over Japan, threatening to shoot near Guam, and would we take a missile shot at Guam as an act of war? So we're a long way from that right now. So I think you have to, that is some progress. So we'll talk to Grant tomorrow about that. And then on Friday, General Zinni going to join us to talk Iwo Jima. He's a huge fan of the battle, so we're going to talk about it. Anyway, and I'm on a personal note, I can't tell you how excited I am for that. I'm going to have to, like, rein in my geeky excitement on Friday and in order to do that interview. So have a great day on a Wednesday, All Marine Radio. Over and out.